This is Paul Nobles from Eat to Perform, and we have a special podcast today because typically we do not do guests. Occasionally we have some guests, and today we have Alan Aragon. Alan is the author of Flexible Dieting. It's probably a longer title, but I think he's probably the authority that I would go to for that. Alan, why don't you say hi and then let everybody know the actual title of the book?
You can start off with a complicated question. Well, hello everyone, and thank you so much, Paul, for having me on the show. This has been a really, really long time coming. It feels like I've known you for over 10 years or something to that effect. My book is called Flexible Dieting, and it has some sort of subtitle that the publishers thought of, which I actually don't have memorized, amazingly. I originally wasn't even going to call the book Flexible Dieting, but this is a title that my friend Brett Contreras basically advised me on titling the book to make it catchy and memorable and somewhat of a within the hot items that the masses would want to consume. But really, the book is a book on evidence-based non-clinical nutrition. So, but if I titled it that, then I might barely sell 10 copies of it. So
Yeah.
yeah, I'm happy to be here, Paul. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, the concept of flexible dieting, if I'm correct, and I don't want to say anything out of pocket, but if it fits your macros was sort of the original part. And then all of a sudden, everyone started eating Pop-Tarts nonstop. And then, I think some of the sciencey people came in and said, hey, maybe we should call it this. Is that a fair thing to say?
The story goes pretty far back. Back in the mid 1970s, in the literature, the psychology literature, there is a concept called cognitive restraint. And so the flexible dieting, as it appeared first in the literature and really kind of picked up in the 1990s, was an examination of different types of dietary restraint or different cognitive styles of dietary restraint. So there was flexible dietary restraint and then rigid dietary restraint. And this was, like I said, research in the 90s. And over the ensuing 2 or 3 decades, there was a consistency of studies showing that flexible dietary restraint was a better approach for not just body weight management, but also lowering the chances of developing eating disorders. So, that's kind of the real story behind the term flexible dieting. And what happened in the 2010s was the fitness industry grabbed that term and made it synonymous with macro counting, which is actually false per the literature, because macro counting is just one of many styles of dieting. And flexible dieting is the umbrella term that says, hey, choose the style of dieting that suits your personality. And you don't even have to stick with that style rigidly throughout the course of a given year. You can go in and out of being precise and being just sort of qualitative. So yeah, that's more of the complicated story behind the term
So
flexible dieting.
this is something that most people within Eat to Perform, but not everyone knows. Well, one, this might surprise you, but we've worked with over 100,000 clients, and
That's
so
fantastic.
we had always viewed ourselves as kind of a cost-effective way that would be more of a competitor with a Weight Watchers or like somebody like a Noom. But interestingly enough, about what you're saying is while we do use a macro-based approach, especially in fat loss cycles and when reversing people out of fat loss cycles, I myself do not count macros once my reverse is done. And I often make a case for it that once you have reversed your calories to what your version of normal is, and we can talk a little bit more about that as we go through the podcast, that you should feel the freedom to not track, right? And another thing that we do is we have a lifetime membership. So we have roughly 10,000 lifetime members that, you know, have paid us throughout the last 12 years, and they go away and come back, which I think is exactly the way I would want it to be, right? So let's get into a little bit, because that naturally segues into how I met you. So I basically come off of 10 years of dieting. And so this might interest you. I believe you still live in California. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. That's where I get my accent from.
Okay. So I spent a lot of time in California because I traveled the world as a professional poker player. And so there's many things that brought me to fitness. But
that is super, wait a minute. That is super interesting. How many people know that? How many people know that? Like, I don't know any professional poker players. You might be the first one.
So that is wild, because are you in LA?
Mm-hmm.
Because yep. LA is one of the hubs for poker. And so it was very common for me to be in LA away from my family. It's also the concept of data, right? So most of, first of all, you know, this might sound a little egotistical, but you could Google me, right? So I was at least that good, right? And so you'll see, like, if you ever Googled Paul Nobles, what you would see is a bunch of images of me obese. Right. So I'm 250, 260 pounds. And it was that. So I'm sitting here, and I'll just say it the way that I actually thought it at the time. But I'm like, how can you be smart enough to beat people out of millions of dollars, yet you cannot figure out a way to control your weight? And so I went, there was two concepts within poker that was very instrumental in my weight loss. One is, whatever your opponents are doing, you want to do the opposite. So what I was seeing was a lot of people that were struggling with this concept of constant weight restriction, right? And so, like, the models that I was, you know, using at that time would have been Weight Watchers, and then later on more into, like, keto and things of this nature. But I saw so many people failing with that. And so logically, my mind went to, okay, one, let's track the data. And two, let's just do the opposite, right? Because I'd known that to be the way that would work the best for me. But as I started showing up on television more and more, and people were like, oh yeah, I think I remember you. I guarantee you, you do not remember me from poker. If I was on television, I was basically the person next to the person they were actually filming, right? And so I went on that path, and very quickly after that path, I messaged you, because I was into paleo, because that was big in the CrossFit world. And at that time I was doing CrossFit, and the opposite of what I was doing in terms of calorie restriction would have been calorie abundance, right? And so I had decided that, you know, being a professional poker player, there was lots of things that went into this decision, but ultimately I decided that I was going to be the one that walked away with money, right? And then I had kind of this time in my life where it's like, well, what am I going to do? What's going to be the next thing? And so what I did at that point was, I said, you'd always said to yourself that if you had the time, you would get in shape. Well, you have the time. It's time to get in shape. And I knew that I did not like working out underfed. And so I just went the opposite way. And so that it was right about that time. I always forget their last names, but Dallas and Melissa Gaddis. They may be urban. They're the Whole 30 people. So I was in touch with them. This was before Whole 30 became what they became, and then now nobody Whole 30s. And I was talking to Dallas quite a bit, right? And was asking him questions. And I remember one question that I asked him. I was like, "Is it okay to eat a, you know, full ribeye every single day?" And he's like, "Absolutely, you know." And then I asked you that same question because I had become familiar with your research review, which I believe started in 2008.
Yeah, that's right.
Our contact would have been around 2010. And your response to me was, "Well, you probably could, but I don't know that you should do that," or something to that effect. And then everything that I was reading, which was more of a science-based, I just hadn't, that clicked with poker. Because what poker was for me was hours worth of research before I sat down and played. So I played mostly online poker. And the big value to online poker was that you could, you know, as long as you were in a game, you could data mine that game. And so I had endless amounts of data on people. And I took that approach with, you know, my weight loss and listening to you and the approach that you were taking. That just was a better fit for what I knew worked in life. Right.
That's
that
cool.
The more data you had, the more you could solve the problem. Right. And so I really owe you a lot of kudos for that, even though I don't think that you probably know that story.
I don't.
It just clicked. And then, you know, there was a lot of, you know, paleo started to wind down because, you know, it really does come down to calories, right? So you can't just eat endless amounts of ribeye and bacon, everything, and not have some repercussions. And so, right about that time, so this you'll find this interesting. So when I was talking to you, and when I was kind of, you know, letting go of the paleo approach, I got very interested in body fat. And I will mention a name that I'm absolutely certain that you know. It's Ansel Keys from the University of Minnesota, who did the starvation experiment. And so the body fat testing facility at the University of Minnesota is the Ansel Keys Physiology Department, or I don't know what they call it, but it's named after him. And I just started traipsing endless amounts of my CrossFit friends to the Spotty Fat facility as part of my data to try and get more data on more people. And of course, I did it with myself. Actually, I started with myself before I started CrossFit. This was actually really interesting and like identifies that newbie gains are like a really big thing. And people don't take advantage of it the way that they should, especially if they're under eating all the time. I wasn't under eating. I was eating 5,000 calories or more every single day, right? I'm tracking it. I'm keeping the data. But I was doing a lot of cardio, right? And so what happened was, is I got to 20 to 21%. But I had already lost 80 pounds. And then the first time I body fat tested, I was 32%. Which I gotta be honest with you, man to man, bro to bro, I started crying. I had worked so hard to get to that place, but I was skinny fat. I don't know if there's a better sciencey way to say that, but what do people call that now? It seems so brutal to say that, but that is kind of what it is, and everybody knows what I mean.
Yep, that's a fair enough way to put it.
Yeah, so I'm 32%. I get down to 21%, and no amount of cardio, No amount of adjusting my macros down, because like I would adjust down from 5,000 occasionally, but rarely for more than like say 2 weeks, right? I was just really all about that effort, and I made it abundantly clear I was working out a lot at that time. And just getting under going from 260 to 200 honestly was easy breezy. Like that was not a problem at all once I had effort in place. But go once I hit 20% with basically no weightlifting, I just got stuck, and there was just no amount of eating less or working out more, or a lot of it was high heart rate stuff, right? So I know you've probably seen a lot of research
What was
where,
your body weight at 20%?
at 20%, I would have probably been around 175-ish, maybe even down to 165. So I had basically lost 100 pounds at that point.
So that's a really good spot. 20% at 170-ish. That's a good
Yeah.
spot. But you just
Yeah.
wanted more.
Well, yeah, it's sort of interesting that you say that, because I think a lot of people are 20% or find out that they're 20% and think that there's just no point in working out. Right? And I'm just like, if you're 20% body fat, you're probably, I mean, you know the research, right? I would say top 10% in terms of body fat percentage. Like,
You're
not a lot
lean.
of people. Yeah, you're pretty lean at 20%.
Yeah.
And for women, you could probably up that number to 25 to 28%.
Yeah,
If
low
you're 25,
30s. Yeah.
yeah, if you're 25 to 28%, you're pretty much crushing it. Like
Like if you as a man you're getting 20% on some devices, you're going to get as low as 15% on other devices. And
Yep.
so you're already in that bracket of healthy and
Yeah.
even even lean to a degree. I mean, because some people will argue about what lean really means, but
Yep.
lean enough for sure for health.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so basically, I don't want to go super into it, but a big piece of Eat to Perform I do owe to the CrossFit community, because I was CrossFitting at that time. I was very careful with the CrossFit thing, because what I was doing CrossFit wise was a little bit different than what everyone else was doing. And so the guy that I was working out with, he was a platoon leader for the Army Rangers. And he just trained us like Army Rangers. There was only like 20 or 30 of us in the gym. We weren't posting shit to YouTube. We did everything like incognito, right? Which I think is kind of the way like he just liked to operate. And once I started CrossFitting, I went from 21 to 8, got down to 149, basically looked like a 13-year-old that was ripped, right? And 13-year-old ripped was not the look I was going for. And so it took me about 2 years to kind of make that adjustment. And then I started blogging and I started to gain weight, right? And I sat at 165 for probably 3 years. A lot of CrossFit, still working out sometimes two times a day. But that was sort of where my body found balance or homeostasis or however you want to describe it. And then, I think it was like after like my second Tough Mudder, I was like, okay, I'm fit, right? I don't have to prove anything to anybody, and I just started blogging about it. And I thought, it'd be dudes like us, they'd be like, oh man, this guy, he's so tough, Tough Mudder, he never deadlifted, now he deadlifts 515. But women showed up to the blog, and what they wanted and what they heard was, wait, I can eat more calories because I am spinning my wheels under eating all the time. And that has started a 12-year journey of those conversations. And so so I thought, man, you know, there's a lot of real, you might know this, Alan, there's a lot of real gangster dudes on the internet. I was never gonna out David Goggins, right? And so I think I found my niche, but my niche was really more involved with the non-dieting period, right? At that time, I did not know. We did, you know, I wasn't calling things dieting periods, non-dieting periods. You know, I wasn't near as evolved as we would become. But my conversations with you led to my conversations with Mike Nelson. And then ultimately, you know, I'm not going to say I didn't have a general understanding of how, you know, businesses worked. I had run many businesses, and the fitness thing and Eat to Perform ultimately became my next thing. And I realized that I could bring something to the market, focusing on the non-dieting cycles rather than the dieting cycles. And so we can kind of go off of that if you'd like, because I think that might be the meatiest topic as it relates to anything that we would talk about. But I was using the concepts that ultimately became your book. I did have some influence from Martin Burkhan at that time with intermittent fasting. I just liked eating bigger meals. In fact, my comeuppance in the CrossFit world was me writing intermittent fasting protocols for like 12-hour windows, which, you know, I would even argue is debatable whether that's intermittent fasting. And because, like, if you remember, like, the concept was just like skip breakfast. I was like, well, I don't really eat breakfast anyway, you know. And it's like, if you were calling intermittent fasting, fine. But there would be just all these people that were coming to me in the CrossFit world, and they were like, yeah, I like eating big meals too. Is there any way you could design a diet for me? And I was like, yeah, you know, and I would send it to him, a blog about that for the day. I remember we had like a cinnamon roll challenge, and everybody at that time was talking about sugar addiction and all this other type of stuff. And people just shocked that they could remain weight stable eating a cinnamon roll before bedtime. Or after 6 o'clock, because I was trying to kind of show people, like, a lot of the research that, you know, you've brought to bear over the course of many years, you know, the average person doesn't realize they can introduce these small things into their life, and then they can become like their own research, right? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, any thoughts on kind of that before we kind of move on, because I'd like to really delve into the non-dieting piece of it, because frankly, we were the first one on that in a real way, right? Now, I will say this, the concept of a non-dieting period has been well known, and it's so funny because, like, I remember when I first started, people were like, well, where's the science behind what you're saying? I was like, there's endless amounts of science about what I'm talking about. But this idea that you're going to starve yourself forever or eat, you know, broccoli and chicken forever, that is the part that hasn't been researched. But like the concept of bodybuilders and coming out of a dieting period and you know, eating around a competition and not. Some of the research that you guys did related to protein and ingesting protein, how much, anabolic windows, right? That all that stuff was out there, you know? And so it wasn't, you know, I could basically just go to your research review and then start implement that. And at that time, we weren't coaching anybody. We were just like, we would sell various books. I was a big affiliate for Reebok at one point. So we would just kind of like concepts, and we would sell based on almost like an influencer, right? And so can we talk a little bit about that because I think that would probably be the part that you're most interested in with Eat to Perform. What is your, no, I don't know the answer to this question. I know you from the research. I don't believe you coach that many people, right? I think you worked with some of the Lakers and stuff like that in the past. But I don't believe that you coach that many people. Is that correct?
I was a full-time personal trainer for 10 years.
Okay.
And then the following 10 years, I was a full-time nutritional counselor. So I have 20 years of full-time coaching people. A
Okay.
lot of people don't know that. They think I just, gather up with my research buddies and we crank out studies and papers, but I literally kept a roof over my head, seeing clients on a
Okay.
consultation basis and a counseling basis. But a lot of people don't know that.
Yeah, no,
So
that's
yeah.
interesting. So
Hundreds, hundreds of clients one-on-one.
in that
Possibly
counseling role,
thousands, but if you count groups, yeah.
but in that counseling, am I correct in stating that there wouldn't have been a lot of people coming to you for reverse dieting? Reverse dieting, I would say when we started doing it was really based on my concept of eating 5,000 calories. And I knew most people could not work out that as much as I was doing at that time. And I don't work out that much now. And so there was kind of this balance of what that number was. But what I definitely knew was just adding 200 calories and calling that maintenance was, that's what a lot of people view as reverse dieting, right? And so, can you talk a little bit about the history of people reverse dieting from bodybuilding? Because once again, this is not something that's new, but it is something that people are starting to figure out. Okay, just eating 1,200 calories for the rest of my life is not going to work.
Yeah, so what my counseling career, nutritional counseling career, it was from 2002 to 2012. That was when I did it full time. Prior to that, I did personal training full time from 1992 to 2002. But during the personal training era, there was a lot of informal nutritional counseling that goes on. Because that's
Yeah.
just what personal trainers do. We wear both hats. We wear the in
Yep,
quotes
yep.
nutritionist hat, we wear the psychologist hat, and of course, we wear the trainer's hat. And so during the 1990s, there was a lot of competition going on with bodybuilding and fitness. It was a hot thing. And then during the following decade, there's still a lot of competition. And that's what during that second decade, that's when the concept of reverse dieting kind of popped up, like in the 2010, 11, 12-ish. And so during that time period, the idea of reverse dieting was to slowly transition out of the competition phase for typically for a physique competition. And the concept was, okay, we need to have a plan. Once we're at the end of the diet, instead of just binging for 3 days and gaining 20 to 30 pounds during that post-contest binge period. So reverse dieting began as kind of a firewall against the post-contest binge. And what coaches would do at that time, go ahead. Go ahead.
So, no, I just wanted to interject here and ask you a question
Sure.
that you're talking about the fittest of the fit, right? People that are doing bodybuilding competitions, but not necessarily just your average Joe or Jenny or whatever, right?
Yes. Yeah, that
I
came
think that's a,
later.
yeah, that's a, that's an important part of this discussion because, like I'm saying, this is a relatively new concept. We do have a lot of data, I think it's going to jive with what you're probably going to say, but let's keep going with that.
Sure. And so a typical reverse dieting protocol for a competitor post contest was, it really got popularized by the guys in the natty bodybuilding world, like Lane Norton. Their reverse dieting models were these tiny incremental increases in calories weekly, in order to, in quotes, reverse somebody out of the dieting phase. I had been quite critical of that model because it was a little too gradual. In some cases, it would take people months to even get back to their pre-dieting caloric intake. And so the increments that they reversed out of it were just far too small. And what it did was it prolonged their caloric deficit during a time period when they really needed to recover just mentally, physiologically, hormonally from the dieting phase. And so in my research review, I actually wrote an article called "Does Reverse Dieting Build Metabolic Capacity?" And the article was just very critical of this slow, weeks and months long process of getting back to maintenance. And I proposed that, hey, let's get people back to maintenance as soon as possible after the post-contest period. Go ahead.
So for context, and I know this is a ballpark, and I know that the science people don't love this, but maintenance for a woman, the number would be a ballpark of what? Maintenance for a man would be a ballpark of what? Because I think that would help the conversation.
Got it. Got it. So women's maintenance, generally speaking, ballpark is mid to high teens on the low end and low to high twos on the high end, depending on the person's body size and activity level. Now, men would be more like low 2000s on the low end, and then high 2000s, the low threes on the high end. And even up to mid threes on the high end for typical men
Yeah.
and
Okay,
typical women. So, yeah.
so this is a great time for me to interject my experience. I also so we started with the idea because we knew that reversing people's calories was a big part of the model, right? And we knew that people needed that. And I think you kind of glossed over something that is a much bigger part than a lot of people would give credit to. It's the mental aspect of it, right? And it's there was something related to weight loss medication recently that came up on CNN, and they were talking about mental health issues and losing hair and things of this nature. And I was just like, oh, those aren't weight loss medication side effects. Those are dieting side effects, right? And so when you're extreme dieting, these are the things that happen. And that's just something that I just don't think that a lot of people kind of place an emphasis on, because like you said, we can get lost in the data. We can get lost in what works and things of this nature. And like you mentioned, when you're a nutrition coach or a personal trainer, you do end up being like a pseudo psychologist to people, right? And that's something we faced. I think you probably are aware of this, that Lane's model, he still does through his app, is they do kind of an incremental approach. Most of the automated apps, whether that's right or wrong, we can kind of talk about that. The problem is that if people don't have a coach and they are coaching themselves, they're going to get stuck around 1500 to 1600, especially as it relates to women. Guys tend to push it a little bit more, almost too much, right? But for women, they will get stuck at whatever their lowest weight is. And so, how do I know this? Because they all come to me and say, that's exactly what happened. right? They started following these automated systems, and the automated systems aren't designed to get things to where they were. We were in discussions with Amazon at one point, and part of the discussions was to show them 300 files. And we blew them away with what people were eating, because while you're working with like bodybuilders and physique competitors, you know, in California, people, you know, want abs to go to the beach. You know, I'm in Minnesota,
Yeah.
so like, you know, we don't have the same requirements. I used to joke that if I lived in California, I would have been jacked all the time. But what your instincts were 100% correct. In fact, the faster you can do it, the better. I say this all the time. I've done it myself many times. The difference between something I will do for me or something I might do for a man or somebody I might know is that mentally, I'm okay with gaining 3 to 5 pounds, right? I'm okay with gaining 10 to 20 pounds if it suits what I'm doing in that moment, right? And so a lot of what you were doing at that time, I was doing with CrossFitters and triathletes. And so their macro requirements were through the roof. I mean, we had women eating. I remember doing a podcast with Lane, and he was sort of bragging about how, you know, he had two gals that he was working with, and, you know, they're back to normal at 1800. And I was just laughing because I just had like regular CrossFitters that were on staff eating 3,500 and jacked, right? Different physique, different, you know, kind of standard, but we had a lot of proof very early on that the faster you pushed it, the better, right? And then, you know, you would have various things where people would get injured or whatever, and they would struggle kind of adjusting. And over the course of years, we've figured out all these protocols to kind of deal with that. But that's so interesting. I did not know. Before I asked you the question, I did not know that that was your answer.
Yep.
But that is one of the criticisms that I do have. I think AI is great, right? There's some people calling things AI that's not actually AI, though. And if you just like adding 50 calories a week, one, you know, my big criticism. So a mutual friend of Alan and I is Susan Kleiner, and Susan, you know, so just so you know, I always knew I was not the science person. So I always hired people to be the PhD to kind of help me. My first person was also a mutual friend in Mike Nelson. And so the tree that was surrounded Alan was sort of the tree that I kind of picked from, right? And but we figured out very quickly, you know, that the quicker we could do it. And in fact, we'll do it as quick as 200 calories twice a week. So up to 400 calories a week, even for women, even your numbers that you did ballpark fit right in line with how we do it, right? Now,
cool.
what I will say is that if you're a woman and you're 120 pounds and your maintenance, I struggle with the word maintenance. Susan hates the fact that I struggle with the word maintenance because she's thinking of it from a scientific standpoint. And I'm thinking of it as a mental obstacle that is keeping people from pushing their natural genetics, right? And so if you're sitting there at 1600 thinking your maintenance is 1600, I can virtually guarantee you it's not, right? And you're probably working out at 60% most of the time and don't know it. And so pushing that genetic potential, pushing what you're doing in the gym, those are all things that have their foundations in bodybuilding. But the average person doesn't know this because they come from a Weight Watchers background or things of this nature. And so it's just interesting. We don't really have to go into it that much more. Because we're a little short on time. We've got about 15 minutes. I definitely don't want to cram a bunch of stuff into the 15 minutes. But as we're moving into greater acceptance of weight loss medication and weaning off weight loss medication, all the data that we have actually supports kind of the direction that people need to go with weight loss medication. My biggest concern, so you mentioned earlier the concept of eating disorders and things of this nature as it relates to some of the concepts that with natural bodybuilding and stuff like that. What I see as one of the biggest concerns is people doing this medication with no support. And I know it's like, well, that's really convenient for you since your coaching service that serves a lot of people. It's like, well, it also happens to be fact, right? You may not know this, but if you were to search hashtag Ozempic or Mounjaro on TikTok, what you would see is a lot of obese people that are shooting up online as sort of a middle finger to the diet industry, right? Of see, your thing didn't work for me. That's a whole nother podcast. We won't get into that concept, right? Because we just can't get lost in that. I have a sympathetic heart to that, right? And the reason why I have a sympathetic heart to that is not because it's wrong. It is wrong. But I have a sympathetic heart to that because you know from your experience, I know from my experience, I think everybody knows that the non-dieting period is important. What I think we've done as the diet industry is one, we've sold suffering too long, and we've not sold the concept, which I think is the emphasis of your book. I remember one of the concepts in your book, and I really loved it so much. It was where you describe body fat percentage, right? And at the bottom, it said something like 20% still healthy, but has a great personality or
That's
something of
right.
that nature.
Yes.
And I think the great majority of people, I definitely got obsessed with body fat percentage because it was just like, I have the time, I have the know-how. Why wouldn't I do this just to see what it's like, right? But I feel way more comfortable at 15, 18%, especially as it relates to performance. I might change that a little bit because of pickleball, just because, being 170 might be a little bit better on my joints than being 190. But also, I told you earlier, like, I'm not here to look like a 13-year-old, right? I'm trying. So I think I'm probably going to explore a little bit more of the resistance training. I've had a hard time mixing my resistance training with my pickleball. I play pickleball 2, 3 hours a day. It's wears you down, right? And so the thought of like, putting 350 pounds on my back and sitting down while my joints ache, I've just struggled with that. So I've done mostly push up, pull up routines, things of that nature. My quads are fine actually, right? Because you're doing a lot of stopping and starting. But I don't mean to get distracted from that. But I think that what we sort of found out with Eat to Perform that is probably the most interesting thing. I need to get back to the Amazon thing. Amazon was freaked out by our data. They weren't even interested in it at all, which is really surprising because the whole business concept of Amazon. But it wasn't like I was talking to Jeff Bezos, right? I was talking to the person that was leading their Halo platform. And I don't know if you ever encountered them, but they encountered a lot of people like you and I, right? And I think that they rightly so, wanted to find a solution for the people that are over consuming all the time. And I want to tie up that piece of things because we just talked about it a little bit. You and I both know that the big majority of the problem is over consuming, right? and overconsuming calories, not being more careful about weight management, things of this nature. But where the emphasis of Eat to Perform is that the two don't exist outside of each other, right? Is this concept of, and I know you've been very critical of clean eating and paleo and things of this nature. What I don't think people realize, and what I really would love to hear you talk on, is the consequences of getting stuck eating very low calories and then not reaching your real goals, reaching fitness goals, reaching health goals. Because there's a lot of people that have felt lied to, I remember from the paleo. Right? There was like, oh, this is going to be so healthy for you and things of this nature. And then their cholesterol levels are through the roof. Right? And so that's where the ribeye thing, I appreciate you. I stopped eating ribeyes because of you. And stopped eating so much saturated fat and just balanced things. Right? It wasn't that I didn't eat it. So talk a little bit about that, because I think that it's your experience as a trainer, your experience as a nutrition. I feel like if you're just dealing with people, you show me someone overconsuming, I can get that person to lose a lot of weight really easy. But that's not who shows up at Eat to Perform. Who shows up at Eat to Perform is somebody that's been eating 1,200 calories for the last 5 years, and they had no option out. So why don't you? I know I gave you a lot there, but specifically, I want you to talk about like some of the mental stuff related to clean eating or paleo, or just like your general opinion, maybe not necessarily super sciencey.
Okay. So at the risk of getting super sciencey.
No, you're fine. You're fine.
there's a concept called energy flux. We can take an example of a very low energy flux state and then a very high energy flux state. So a very low energy flux state would be, let's take an extreme example, somebody who is bedridden. Okay, so they have like no voluntary energy out. They're just lying around all day. And so therefore, their maintenance requirements are very limited in terms of their energy consumed or their energy in. So that right there is a very low energy flux state. Now we take the other extreme. Somebody who is, let's say, training for 4 to 6 hours a day. And let's say they're training for the Olympics. Okay, the Olympic Games. And so therefore, their caloric requirements, let's say these two people are the same body size, the caloric requirements of the person training for the Olympics may be 2 to 3 times greater than the person who's bedridden. Okay, so what we can do is we can look at those two scenarios, and they're the same weight. These people are the same weight, but there's very different things going on physiologically with each of these two people. And there's also different things going on psychologically with these two people. So what happens with chronic dieting, and when you bring up the example of somebody who has been subsisting on, let's say, 1,200 calories a day for a long period of time, what happens with that scenario is that the person is physiologically and in some cases psychologically depressed, and they're at a state of low energy flux. And what happens when you raise the energy flux, in other words, you simultaneously increase energy intake and energy output, and this is where a gradual increase in energy flux can be beneficial, then you essentially train the person to use incoming calories and fuels in a better way. And so you can increase somebody's energy flux. They don't necessarily gain weight. And in some cases, they even lose weight. But you are creating a better scenario for the person in terms of their physical health and conditioning, as well as the adaptations, the positive adaptations that they will incur from the training program and through increasing their physical activity. So there's not just one single way to help somebody lose body fat or improve body composition. The whole focus on, okay, just eat less and move more, that only goes so far, because there's only so far you can take the eat less side. And of course, there's only so far you can take the move more side. But the approach of eat more, move better, or in, you know, or move more, eat more, move more, or eat more, move better. And if that's done in a systematic way, then that is sort of the newer model of, in quotes, reverse dieting that we're seeing. And just from a scientific standpoint, what you're really doing is increasing the person's state of energy flux. And that is an option that's out there. And that's obviously an option that works with a lot of your clients. And it's something that I have to admit, it's something that we didn't necessarily focus on or put to practice on a regular basis back in the 90s. So there you go.
Yeah, so it's interesting. Mike Nelson, Mike T. Nelson, his concept of metabolic flexibility, that whole idea has been sort of bastardized by the low carb community. But whenever I see Mike or talk to Mike lives across town from me. I always tell him, "Hey, man, just so you know." You were right. But not necessarily right from the standpoint of you eat super low carb one day and you eat super high carb around your workouts on another day, right? There we took, Mike wrote a book for us, still to this day, the best-selling book we've ever sold, right? But that book would not be relevant to the way that we do Eat to Perform now, because we don't, we definitely tested that idea with thousands of people where you would go super low carb as low as 30, like keto basis, right? And then go the other way on the days around your workouts. And what we found was is that on those days, it was just too big of an adjustment. So we just found that people would respond better to say 150 grams of carbs if their higher carb days were 300 grams of carbs, right? And we're testing these with athletes. I've worked with probably 20 to 25 CrossFit Games athletes, sort of depend on what you consider to be a CrossFit Games athlete, because Masters athletes, virtually every Masters athlete was doing Eat to Perform at one point. But Olympians, like you said, we had an Olympian, 115 pound, 110 pound. She was eating 3150 most of the time as an average, and did virtually no cardio, right? And the coolest thing from a research standpoint, I've never, like, her superpower was sleep. She slept anywhere from 11 to 12 hours a day. And I really, to this day, she's actually one of the better, once we kind of took her mother worked for me. We just sort of took her to where she is now. And then from there, USA Weightlifting sort of takes over, and your Andy Galpans and those kind of people, right? But it was sort of interesting just seeing her sleep. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that concept, though, of 1200, because, I'm not going to name names, but we were in talks to, I was going to buy a piece of one of the automated places because I thought I could bring something to the table, that they they didn't have, and I thought they could bring some things to the table that I didn't have. And the deal got stuck on the idea that continuously eating 1200 calories for the course of years, that they're lying. And their main, like, nutritionist, or I can't remember what her credentials were, but she was like, if they're not losing weight, they're lying. And I struggled with that so much, what she said there. Because I remember there was this lady at my gym, and she said, I had Dairy Queen one time and it ruined everything. And you and I know what that means, right? She had Dairy Queen one time and she remembered, oh, that's right. I can live a life that's not miserable. And I can go. And I tried to express to her, I was like, it's not the eating 1,000 calories or the 1,200 calories. You just are doing it as if that is the way that you live. And you don't want to be miserable for the rest of your life. There's another way to do it. You can do it in cycles. The cycle could be 3 months. The cycle could be 6 months. It's going to really matter as it relates to your diet adherence. This is interesting. So I definitely want your opinion on the 1200 thing and the people, because I know that there's some research out there that says they're lying to you. They're not, you know. I'm just saying, I know they're lying a little bit, but they ain't lying that much, right? There's a lot going on there, but I thought it was, I think that as trainers and nutritionists and like I kind of lend myself more to stoicism, where it's like, I want to view things as my problem so I can help the solutions. But if I point the finger and say, it was your Dairy Queen that you did in July that screwed you, right? Or this one thing that you ate, I just don't know that that helps people. And I think that sometimes, even from the most sciencey of the science, they still rely on that. And I'm like, well, okay, but can't we at least have the discussion of the psychology of eating 1,000 calories, or can we at least have the discussion? Like, thoughts on that?
Okay, so there's a couple layers here. The first aspect is that the general public with obesity in particular tend to underreport caloric intake and overreport physical activity. And so there are examples in the literature of that. And the examples range up to and even a little bit over 1,000 calories that are essentially unaccounted for or that are misreported. So if somebody's claiming an intake of 1,200 calories, there have been literature examples where they're eating 2,500 calories. So there's always the misreporting potential. Now, of course, the challenge comes in when somebody has been tracking everything down to the last little detail, and there's very little reason to believe they're misreporting 1,200 calories. And so there are always going to be individuals who don't fit the mold of what's reported in research studies. So we always have to remember that the results reported in the research literature are means. So they're averages of the group, they're group averages. And so any sort of research study, there are going to be people in the group who are hyper responders, hypo responders, and everything in between. So it's a mixed bag of results of people falling above the mean and below the mean and everywhere, every point in between. And so therefore, you can't really point to the literature and say, hey, this is gospel that applies to everybody, because you're looking at a group average. So if you trust that the individual is being accurate with their intake. And bear in mind, Paul, it is very common for people to be inaccurate, and it is also common for people to not report binge episodes. And this was very common in the fitness community and the contest dieting community. But there are people who are honest, and in those cases, that's when you have to say, okay, this person needs a different approach other than restrict, restrict, restrict more. What they need is a break from the dieting process, both physical and mental. And there is a mounting body of research showing that non-linear dieting, so dieting that is either infused with breaks or with non-dieting periods, is a successful tactic for long-term weight loss. So there's always that.
So, okay. No. So I told you I would keep you. So I'm going to keep this short. But can't we explain some of what those people's experiences are that say, hey, I have been tracking and I mm-hmm. have been eating 1200. Doesn't the body's need for balance explain why they're not losing weight anymore? Right? Like let's say that what you're saying is true, right? That is a subset. See, this to me, so you probably don't know this, but all of our subscriptions can be canceled at any time. We did that very early on, and we did that with the basic concept of we're going to get the best we possibly can be if we are serving people like we don't have the exact answer at all times, right? Like the answer, I think the answers that most people want are black and white. But what you keep describing over and over again is a foundational piece of each form, that the real magic's in the gray, the real magic. And this is why the people shooting up on TikTok and things of this nature that are giving the FU to the diet community, what they're saying to the person that's saying to you, I know you're over-consuming, I know you're reporting wrong, things of this nature. They're saying, I don't want to be dehumanized by you, right? I am someone in pain and I need help. And they go too far in the period where they're not focused on health, or they're having trouble with carb payments and they're overeating as a result of it and things of this nature. But they don't view the person that said to them, you're overconsuming, as an ally in their journey, right? Because they did work hard. I know for 10 years, that model did not serve me. And I'm not saying that that model, we know that that model is highly inefficient though, right? The you know, there's studies as it relates to Weight Watchers and things of that nature. And then the people, we could argue on whether or not the studies were designed right and staying weight stable. But that model of just eat less, right? And not factoring in things like diet breaks, we know that there's some flaw there, right? Can I ask, I want to speak to diet breaks. We had a lot of other stuff we could have covered. We're not going to cover that. We can maybe do it in a different way. But doesn't the concept of balance and homeostasis sort of explain that some of these people aren't crazy?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of variables, potential variables at play, because people respond differently to dieting in terms of what systems downregulate. And something that's a little bit hard to track is non-exercise activity. And sure, you can use pedometers and things like that, but they don't catch every decrease in people's subconscious movement. And so what happens with a lot of folks when they diet too severely and for too long, their non-exercise activity goes down. And that can be the difference of several hundred calories on average in the dieting process.
So I get why that's a difficult question to handle. And once again, that's probably a 2-hour podcast in and of itself. But I think a little bit of the answer is the question that I'm going to ask you right now. So when you talk about diet breaks, okay, so this is interesting. This is something I know a lot about because of what we do and how we do it. So Lyle McDonald, I think that he was one of the first people that I'd heard of diet breaks. I hope he doesn't hear this. I don't know where his mental health is right now, but I don't want to be attacked by Lyle, that's for sure. But this is one concept that I know is 100% true. Is the concept of being on a diet and then taking a diet break for 2 weeks, and all of a sudden everything goes back to normal and you're fine and you can lose weight. I know for a fact that that's not true. And the more that you do it like that, the more of a negative metabolic response you're going to get, right? So, because, I'm not talking in theory. I took the things that I was reading from you. I took what Lyle was talking about and used it with thousands of people. And people did not respond to that really well. Now, some people could argue, and by the way, Lyle might have changed his mind by now, right? That is the one good thing about science. We're good about changing our minds. The problem is that people want black and white solutions, but the answer is in the gray. But what people don't understand is that gray will also get you quite far, right? So, if you have a lot of weight to lose, being in a calorie deficit for 3 to 6 months probably makes a lot of sense, right? And building in some level of diet breaks. So here's how we do diet breaks. And once again, this is, when you can customize coaching, you can change things to what the client's responses are, right? But what we consistently found was, is that if somebody did a four, so we break it into two, right? So we have a 6 week fat loss cycle, right? Because you can do basically any amount of fat loss cycles that you want to get the end result that you need. And so in that time, if someone loses 10 to 15 pounds, if you had a lot of weight to lose, you can lose, even more than that. As an example, if you're still losing weight after 6 weeks, we won't stop you, right? We'll continue allowing you to lose weight. But a lot of our clients, as I mentioned earlier, they're 140 and want to be 120. They're not necessarily 300 pounds and want to be, stop at 250. So what we found was that if those people could take diet breaks of 2 to 3 months and we could get them their calories back to relative normal, not necessarily where they are in a complete non-dieting phase, we could get better results, right? So if we only did it for 2 weeks in the second phase, they might lose 6 pounds. If we could do it for 4 weeks, they might lose 8 to 9 pounds. But what we consistently found was the people that we went to 2 to 3 months, and this is interesting. You know what naturally taught us to do this was the holidays and summer. What we found was is the people that actually went off plan for the summer always came back and lost more weight. And so we started programming the protocol to where the diet breaks would be longer. And so what I think is, once again, this is not, we are not dealing with the Z competitors, right? That are constantly concerned about 0.2 amount of body fat, right? We're just concerned with average healthy people. And for the people pursuing health, we found that diet breaks of 2 to 3. So just to describe it, and once again, this is all flexible. But this is the general parameters our coaches have taught. 6 weeks, anywhere from 2 to 3 months for a diet break, and then another 6 weeks. And usually we can expect 20 to 25 pounds in that cycle, right? So we can get a little bit better than the standard 1 pound a week thing, right? Certainly you could do it for 3 to 6 months. We are coming to the end. I will make the case that protocol is changing with weight loss medication, because if you think about why that protocol exists, it's not necessarily all physiological, right? A lot of it's mental. Having people have an end date of food comes back. I mean, if you could see our group, you would just be like, wow, people are so excited for the non-dieting period, right? But the idea, and I think this is the idea that both of us probably would agree on, no matter what you're doing, keto, intermittent fasting, eating warm, Weight Watchers, that if you viewed it all as cycling and you normalize calories and you up your mental health, if you upped your activity and all these different things, you're gonna find the right balance. But what you can't do is just take a one-way ticket to fucking Phil and just go, well, that didn't work. It didn't work because your black and white solution was black and white, right? And so it's all gray. If you view it as gray, you'll be much better off. If you read Alan's research review, if you buy his flexible dieting book, what you're going to find is that the same thing that I found, that the more you pursue, you are the answer to your problems, you're going to find the best answers. We were going to talk about weight loss medication. I did want to make the one case that a lot of your research, a lot of what you're talking about with flexible dieting is a really good fit. I did not get, well, last note, and you can say whatever you want, but what are your thoughts on the diet break piece that I just said?
I honestly think it's fantastic. And I've always looked at weight loss plateaus as not a negative thing, but as an opportunity to practice maintenance during a phase en route to the ultimate goal. So I've always taught clients that plateaus are not a bad thing. You know, if you can maintain a certain level of progress, that's as legitimate of a goal as pushing forward, pushing forward, pushing forward. And it's just as hard to maintain progress that you've made over a period of time as it is to just keep blasting forward. And ultimately, the goal is a plateau of sorts. So these sort of the shape of progress, the way it looks, is each progress phase gets less dramatic and each plateau gets longer, and that's how it's supposed to look. So
So if
you
I
know
was to
that
say, Alan Aragon said this, plateaus are a signal.
plateaus are actually a good thing. And they should get longer and longer. So I've always viewed it that way. And when people sort of make that mental switch and look at plateaus as maintenance practice, then it's totally productive. As opposed to looking at plateaus as some sort of failure and some sort of opportunity to sniff around for the next greatest quick fix.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. All right, Alan. Like I said, Alan Aragon's research review. I've been a member since 2008. Alan's book on flexible dieting is, I would argue the best book as it relates to, it's better than Susan's book. It's Power Eating. Power eating is sort of when you're pushing it to that highest level. Flexible dieting, Alan's book, is the meats and potatoes of that piece, right? And it's a little bit different because he's not necessarily always talking about macros, but I think, even as someone that teaches people to use that data, I'm a big believer in the fact that you shouldn't be imprisoned by that data. Right. And so I think Alan's book is really great in that regard.
I
All right,
appreciate
Alan,
that.
I really appreciate you taking the time. Next time I'm in Ojai, we'll stop and grab some coffee. But I appreciate
Or
you
a
doing the
ribeye.
podcast. Yeah,
Or a
we'll do that
ribeye.
too. All right, man. Talk to you later.
Appreciate you.
Bye, man. Talk to you later.
Bye-bye.